in Russia. Margaret was in the backyard hanging up the freshly washed clothes. And there were lots of clothes. She and her husband John had been married 12 years, and they already had 6 children. Shortly after they were married, John's father, Jacob, the one who had stepped off the train, had died unexpectedly. John's mother, Anna, didn't want to live alone, so she moved in with the young couple. On this day, while Margaret was outside with her laundry, she began to think about the events of the past week. Though she and John attended church every Sunday, their faith was dead. This week, though, there were special evening services. They were told that attending church was not enough. They had been told that they had to trust Jesus to pay for their sins, and that other things in their lives needed to change, too. Many in their village had responded to the messages of the visiting minister. Then, as Margaret turned back toward the house, the gate abruptly closed in front of her. Was it the wind? She didn't know. She stopped. And then an image came to her mind. She was approaching the gates of heaven, and then those gates closed in front of her. That night, Margaret gave her life to Jesus. The next morning, her husband John, while kneeling in front of a chair, did the same. A few months later, John and Margaret's children noticed their mom and dad coming home from a church meeting with a bundle of wet clothes to hang out on the line. They had been baptized. John and Margaret were my grandparents. A genealogy is an ordered record of names and dates. This book contains one side of my family, thousands of names and dates of births and deaths and marriages. There are very few stories in the pages of this book, but it is the stories that I heard from my aunts and uncles when we got together that make books like this come alive. The book of Matthew includes Jesus' family lineage as part of his birth narrative. Luke places the genealogy a little further along, but we hardly, if ever, read these genealogies. For the Jewish reader, each name represents a story or stories. For this Advent season, Pastor Lorne and I have prepared to pull out some of these stories and show their connection to the Messiah. Out of the Stump of Jesse is the title of our Advent series. And this is a stump to show that. And I know it's ugly in front of our Christmas decorations, but that's the point. That's the point Isaiah was making. So we want to discover, hopefully in new ways, how God brought life and promise from that which showed no promise. So this stump will be our visual reminder that where there was no life, God brought life and continues to bring life out of the stump of Jesse. So, can we move to Abraham? Throughout Scripture, we read that God chose certain people to carry out his will. As we look at the genealogy of Jesus, we will pick out some of the specific ones that he selected to be in the list of Jesus' earthly ancestors. So the word is chosen. Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him, for I have chosen him, so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. Abraham was just a nomad, a wandering herdsman. Together with his father and his two brothers, they moved their families and flocks to follow wherever the grazing was good. The land of Ur was east of the current country of Jordan into the southern part of Iraq. While living there, one of Abraham's brothers had died. So Abraham had taken his brother's son into his care and treated him much like his own son. This younger man was Lot. Then one day God said to Abraham, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation." So the first thing Abraham was asked to do after being chosen was to leave town. He left quite a bit behind to accept the promise of becoming a great nation. He left his father's household, which meant leaving any inheritance. He left behind his familiar country. He even left behind household gods that had been passed down from generations. You see, at that time, Abraham did not know the true God. God had asked Abraham to move, so he did just that, and moved to the land of Canaan. He had no sooner arrived when a famine came to his new land, and he had to move again, this time to Egypt. I wonder what Abraham and Sarah thought about this setback. After the famine was over and after moving back to Canaan, Abraham began to wonder about God's promise of an heir. Apparently, Lot wasn't to be his heir. Lot had chosen a different land, land to the east of Canaan. Abraham asked God if his hired man would be his heir. God replied, "Eliezer will not be your heir. You will have a son, your own flesh and blood." And then God waited. He wanted Abraham to know for sure that the promised heir was God's doing, not Abraham and Sarah's. Ishmael, Abraham's son through Sarah's servant, was not the answer either. Abraham was 75 and Sarah 65 when they left their family and home to follow God and his calling. 25 years later, when all human hope would have been gone, God keeps his promise. I should have said hope would be gone. God keeps his promise. And Isaac is born. There is so much more to the story, but I want to focus on God's choice. God chose someone who had no home. God chose someone who had no children. God chose someone who was too old to have children. There are stories that tell of his character, Abraham's character. But the reason James gives for calling Abraham righteous was this: Abraham believed in the impossible, that Sarah, at 90 years old, would be able to have a child. Abraham believed what was impossible would be possible through God. David is the 14th name in Matthew's genealogy of Jesus. Saul, the first king of Israel, sinned so badly that God regretted that he had chosen Saul to be king. So God said to Samuel, "I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king." Well, was David a good candidate for king? David was not Saul's son. Jonathan, with his caring, his understanding of where his father went wrong, his attitude, good attitude, towards God's decisions, should have made him a good candidate to become Israel's next king. David was considered by his own father to be the least of his sons. When he gathered his sons in order to identify which would be the next king, he didn't bother to consider David. Samuel, after going through the seven, had to ask him, "Don't you have any other sons?" "Oh yeah, I forgot about that one. He's out looking after some sheep." David's older brother later thought David was irresponsible. He thought David left the sheep to themselves so he could watch the battle with the Philistines. God saw things differently. God told Samuel that he chose David because he, that is God, could see David's heart. God chose small to show God's power through David. And he was with David. One of Saul's servants heard about David and said of this shepherd, "The Lord is with him." Early on, David displayed skills that made him a different kind of king than Saul and than any other king in the area. This king had a gift in music. Not only did David play the lyre, he also wrote his songs and then sang them. This king had the gift of language. One of Saul's servants said he speaks well. He also wrote. He wrote very well, with such depth that Psalms is the most popular book in the Bible. This king honored God like no other. Twice David had the opportunity to eliminate Saul. Both times, he said that he could not harm the Lord's anointed. He said to Saul, "As I value your life today, may the Lord value my life." After Saul's death, one of Saul's sons, Ish-bosheth, if I can say that correctly, claimed the throne in the north. David was angry when one of his commanders assassinated Ish-bosheth. Bet you can't say it either. After that, David continued to care about other descendants of Saul. He showed honor to the memory of Israel's first king because God had chosen Saul. David was patient. He waited 14 years to become king after being anointed. David was creative. We see that in the story of Goliath. I think I'm going to move on. I won't go through that story. David was contrite when he was faced with his sin. He broke down and asked the Lord for forgiveness when his sins were pointed out. David was chosen out of obscurity to be God's template for an earthly king. Now we will move to the stump slide. Moving chronologically through Jesus' genealogy, we come to Ahaz. This king was one of the worst in Israel's history. He was the opposite of King David. Ahaz doesn't get a slide. We will show that field of stumps instead. Ahaz led Israel away from God and idolatry. One thing that God required of the leadership in Israel was a clear separation between royalty, that is the kings, and the priesthood. Ahaz forced his control over the priesthood and even took the place of priests in the offering of sacrifices. He destroyed the altars built to worship God and replaced them with altars to false gods of the neighboring kingdoms. 2 Chronicles records the worst of the sins of Ahaz. Functioning as a priest, he offered his own children as burnt sacrifices to false gods. And sadly, Israel followed his lead in doing evil. This is the stage for Isaiah's prophecy in Isaiah 6. Though a tenth remains in the land, it will again be laid waste. But as the terebinth and oak leave stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land. This image is Israel likened to a great forest. Each family in this forest of Israel is represented by a tree. Every tree is brought down, and it is the Assyrians that come in and cut down the forest that is Israel. In chapter 10 of Isaiah, God will turn his attention to the Assyrians. After a number of years, the Assyrians have grown and become the new forest in Israel. But this new forest, second forest, will suffer the same fate as the first forest. From Isaiah 10, "See, the lofty trees will be felled. He will cut down the forest thickets with an axe. Lebanon will fall before the mighty one." And so the second forest will also be leveled. And then a miracle. One of the stumps in the forest begins to grow a shoot. And I know you would probably need binoculars, but this stump has a little shoot. Look, we see a shoot growing out of one of the stumps from the first forest, not the second. Look at that. That stump with a shoot is Jesse's stump. And look again, that shoot has become a branch. Now we look in wonder. That branch has fruit on it. Isaiah 11, verse 1. "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him." That shoot is Jesus. In Matthew's gospel, Mary and Joseph are listed as the last of the genealogical line before Jesus. In our scriptures, we have no record of what happened in Israel for the 400 years prior to the events of Matthew 1 and Luke 1. It is considered to be a dark period. Yet there are those who, in spite of the darkness, still serve the Lord. Both Mary's and Joseph's families were ones who served the Lord. Why did God choose Mary and Joseph to be Jesus' earthly parents? Well, first of all, they came as a pair. They had committed themselves to each other in marriage. And secondly, as we saw with Abraham and with David, God chooses small. Mary and Joseph were poor. We know this because they offered doves when they took Jesus to the temple to be consecrated. Twice, Mary describes herself as God's humble servant. First, at the conclusion of her encounter with the angel, and then later when she goes to visit Elizabeth. Her song includes these words, "My soul glorifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has been mindful of the humble nature of his servant." With these words, Mary recognizes that God has chosen her because she is poor and humble, so consistent with the thoughts contained in the Sermon on the Mount. But while Mary was humble and poor, simple she wasn't. On two occasions, Luke records that Mary treasured these things in her heart and pondered them. This suggests a thoughtful person. Now a little on Joseph. Matthew says this about him. Joseph was faithful to the law, yet did not want to expose her to public disgrace. Joseph knew the Old Testament law, but he also knew the spirit of the law. Joseph thought that Mary was unfaithful, but he had compassion on her. Joseph's approach to Mary in their culture should suggest that he already lived the Sermon on the Mount before Jesus taught it some 30 years later. I have a book that disappeared.
It's on the boat, Rob, in front of the river.
Oh, thank you. This is important. Perhaps one thing that might have disqualified Mary and Joseph from being Jesus' earthly parents was where they lived. Nazareth. Nazareth? Can anything good come from there? Asked Nathanael. The Messiah was to come from Bethlehem. Yet Mary and Joseph lived in Nazareth. Perhaps Jesus was safer outside the spotlight of Jerusalem, and Bethlehem was very close to Jerusalem. Kings were known for eliminating rivals. Joyce and I read in a morning devotional written by a Messianic Jew, that is, a Jew who believes that Jesus is the promised Messiah. So I wanted to read a short section from here. What do the prophets say of Messiah? They speak of him as the branch. That word in Isaiah, the Hebrew is netzer, which means branch. Oh, I'm supposed to be reading here. Okay, they speak of him as the branch. Why the branch? For one, he would appear on earth in littleness, in weakness, growing up as a shoot, a sprout. He would be born among us on the tree, the genealogy of humanity. His presence on earth would then grow greater and greater, bearing its fruit to the world. In Hebrew, one of the words for branch is netzer. It is used by Isaiah in his prophecy of Messiah as the branch that springs forth from the line of David. And that's that passage in Isaiah, which talks of the shoot, the branch, that word out of the stump of Jesse. So it is used by Isaiah in his prophecy. Oh, sorry, I read that. If you add an ending, the word netzer becomes netzeret. And Netzaret is the real place you know as Nazareth. Nazareth would mean the place of the branch, the place of the branching forth, the perfect name for the place where Messiah would grow up, a branch, and the place from which he would branch forth. Then why did God choose it if it was the most obscure and unlikely of places? For that very reason, God loves to choose the unlikely. And now for the great irony, as recorded by John. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Judas came, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. They were asking for Jesus of the branch, inadvertently identifying Jesus as the Messiah, or the shoot coming out of the stump of Jesse. "I am he," said Jesus. God chose Mary and Joseph from Nazareth, the place of the branch. Now we will move to 1 Peter. "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation." God chose Abraham to become the first of his new people. God chose David to be king over his new people. God chose Mary and Joseph to be Jesus' earthly parents. Now Peter tells us, those of us who are not of Jewish heritage or parents, those of us who were not at the beginning God's people, now we are his chosen people. The great sin of King Ahaz was to lead Israel away from God. He did this by using his power as king to take control of the priesthood, and then led Israel in sacrificing to false gods. He claimed to be king and high priest. Now here in 1 Peter we have the declaration, "You are a royal priesthood." Royal priesthood. Royalty is inherited. Many people reading this in Peter's day were not royalty. Royalty. I think I read that already. Here Peter is saying that all in Jesus' new kingdom have been elevated to royalty status. The priesthood is also inherited. Only the Levites were to be the priests and have access to God on behalf of the people of Israel. To be a priest was a privilege, and serving in the temple was a privilege. To say you are a royal priesthood is to say the lineage of a king, and the heritage of the priests is available to everyone. Ahaz was not supposed to bring these two together, yet now God has brought these together under one, under Jesus. This declaration started back in chapter 1 of Matthew. The genealogy of Jesus shows that Jesus was king in the lineage of David. Then Joseph is told by the angel that Jesus will be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. No longer is God behind the veil of the temple. That veil was torn in two. We are chosen to join Jesus in his kingdom, and we can have access to God through our new high priest, Jesus. In 1969, seven young men were charged with inciting a riot while they protested their country's participation in the Vietnam War. The trial of the Chicago Seven lasted 6 months. After being convicted, Tom Hayden asked the judge if he could make some closing comments. Then he began to read the name and age of every one of the 5,000 Americans killed in the war during the 6 months that the trial was in session. Reading names, all of them, that caught my attention. Peter says, "You are our chosen people." Everyone who chooses to follow Jesus is chosen. I played over in my head again and again the name of every person in this sanctuary, and I played over in my head how I would read the names of every person watching from home. But it's not for me to read out loud who has chosen for Jesus and who is chosen. I can read this, though. You, here in this building, those of you participating online, you are a chosen people. Once you were not a people, but God does miracles. Now, through Jesus, you are the people of God.